One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
My new book, Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects, is now available to pre-order wherever books are sold, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble and Waterstones. Explore the UFO phenomenon through 34 cases from throughout the world, with accompanying pictures and maps in a beautiful hardback edition or download for your Kindle. Links available in the podcast description below. Hi everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined today by a returning guest. He is a tech entrepreneur, physicist, and experiencer, among many, many other feathers in his cap, but I'd be here all day. So welcome back to the podcast, Deep Prasad. Deep, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much, Andy. It has been a long time, and it's a pleasure. Things are well, brother.
Yeah, it feels like a lifetime.
Many, if at this point.
five years is a long time. And you were one of the very early guests on the podcast, I remember.
I was, yeah, it was great. And I remember you came in at a very strategic time. I was being sort of like going through the ringer, if you will.
Yeah. I don't even remember the exact topic, but I remember it being something like there was some online drama going on. There was a bit of confusion. And then I was like, oh, being new podcaster on the block, I wonder if I just chat to Deep and let him tell his story. And you came on and everything was fine. But listen, 5 years is come and gone, and a whole lot has happened since then. For folks, Deep, who may be listening to this, who aren't on social media, who aren't too sure who Deep Prasad is, do you want to give us a little bit of your background and kind of who you are and what's brought you to the UFO conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the way that I would think about this, Andy, is that my background is formally in industrial engineering. So that's where I'm educated at the University of Toronto. But I've been in tech entrepreneurship basically my entire young adult life. I have a background in quantum computing, quantum chemistry, material science. I launched one of the world's most powerful hyperspectral satellite imagers since the last time we talked, which is pretty cool. It's a satellite. Yeah, I was SpaceX. I've kind of been all over the place, but I think the simplest way to think about it is that my entire career has been focused on the intersection of artificial intelligence and physics. So that actually leads to a whole ton of different applications. Happy to get into, you know, whatever. I recently sold one of the world's first AI for material science companies. I've now used and rolled a lot of the money and liquidity in those funds back into my next company. And that company will be dedicated to essentially developing the fundamental infrastructure needed to make Mars a self-sustaining civilization. So that's the goal.
Deep, I don't often do this, but you are younger than myself, and I often am the youngest on the podcast whenever I speak to
someone.
You're
a young man, my friend.
I'm 39, but listen, you have achieved and experienced so much in quite a young time. Is it fair to say you were a bit of a child prodigy? Because you're clearly very intelligent, and you were doing stuff at the age of 15 and 16 most of us never even get to. Is that right?
I don't want to use the word child prodigy. I will let you decide in the world. At this point, you know, I'm 29, so I feel quite old. But I guess it's all relative to your point, though. You know,
it is. So, totally. And you're heavily involved. Actually, let me strike that. You're not heavily involved in the UFO topic. Is it fair to say you were quite involved and then you almost took a bit of a step back and then you've kind of come back into it with the hackathon, which we're going to get to. But what kind of happened there? Is that just natural? You came into things, you're so busy. You came into the UFO topic. You got involved, like I say, back in the day when I was starting the podcast. And then you've gone away to do other things. What's going to happen there?
Yeah. Oh, man, this could be trip. I don't even know if we're going to finish all this in one sitting. the level of depth of the questions, you know, that you keep asking, like, you know, it's only been like not even 5 minutes. So that being said, I'm going to assume one thing, which is that people will at some point visit our first podcast. This will be good to contrast or like just keep adding to the context.
Yeah.
You know, so in summer 2020, all that drama happens. And ironically, what I was not able to say back then, when even though it was underway and I just couldn't say it like publicly, but I can now because now it's done. Like it's already happened. I was working on this like AI for material science business and the algorithms and working with some of the top $1 trillion tech companies on the planet regarding this topic. So I was one of their alpha customers, to be very specific. And, you know, in this time frame, I was, you know, spending a lot of time sort of both getting really, really, really good at quantum thermodynamics and quantum machine learning for quantum chemistry, validating what I was working on for developing this quantum artificial intelligence, again, with really, really high up, very powerful tech people. Meanwhile, I'm being called a fucking fraud by the UFO community that summer, right? I'm on this podcast. So I was like, imagine the jarring experience, by the way, of going through that, where I'm like, man, I can't say any, I just have to take L's right now and like let these like idiots talk until it's ready, you know, until I've done the thing. So 1 year goes by exactly from that time that we did that podcast. So roughly about a year later, I started GenMat. Which is the name of the company that I sold. And so back then, just for context, and I'll tie this back into UAPs and, you know, and so on and so forth. Back then, there was only three companies max that were working on AI for material science, who had like really the sort of, let's just say, craziness, tenacity, whatever you want to call it, psychosis, you know, to be willing to put millions and millions of dollars towards figuring out how do we actually teach AI to find new materials faster than a material scientist can. And since then, many, many, many breakthroughs have occurred in this field that have made this inevitable, this future, where essentially everything we make, every physical product, every like Mac laptop, all my clothes, all of this stuff, the whiteboard, the materials for this, it's all going to be designed by some sort of artificial intelligence, the very down to the chemical composition and crystal structure. And so I got this company to the point where like we fully developed the stack minus the robotics. I need to do that next, the robotic arm. But we built most of the software and the synthesis patents and techniques. We're some of the only people really who did this for a long time. Now there's like, I would say $1 billion of capital that has been pushed into this space since I first started. I bet that's going to be 10 times more over the next several years. And then, you know, easily 100 times more in the next decade. Once disclosure happens, that becomes an infinite number because you can imagine that, you know, when you have like recovered UAP craft and you have these really advanced materials that have functionality that we can measure, but we don't understand quite fully what is the underlying mapping between the crystal structure / chemical composition and its properties, that understanding that could be the difference between learning hundreds or thousands of years of new science and discovering that new chemistry ourselves, or we can let AI figure it the fuck out like way faster. I kind of took a step back from public facing ufology. I was like, I am just going to keep building the tech stack and working with people who will improve my connectivity to the Department of Defense and generally the US government apparatus, if you will, and the folks who are doing disclosure. So I've donated over $10,000 to Seoul, for example. I threw the world's first UFO hackathon. I hired Ryan Graves a long time ago, which I'm super honored to do, I've had done. I worked with him. We worked with each other for over a year and a half at GenMat. And even, you know, while he was working with us, he even went on Lex Fridman. It was super cool. I kind of try to support the UAP work as much as I could, in the background doing these things. You know, Tim Galladay is an advisor. He has been for a couple of years. George Hathaway, the only Canadian scientist to win a DIRD. He's been a very awesome, vendor for a while. I kind of just built the technology and human network. Now I am just going all in, because now I have both pieces, not just the sort of experience in being a human in the UFO community of understanding that piece of the puzzle, but also having resources now to do things, actually push policy, get shit done if I want to, if I can work my way up to that. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been busy, I think, is the short answer to all of that.
You're hilarious.
That gives some of that background. And I had to just look up while you were talking about the drama thing back in the day. And it was essentially deep, you know, as a young guy, he was coming out with some of these claims of what he was going to be working on, what he may be working on, without saying some of it directly. But I think time has proven that you were indeed working on all that stuff, or you're an incredibly good liar, which brought you to the holding the hackathon you mentioned. So let's talk about that first, because that's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Because when I saw you announced this, it was quite quick, within days, and then it was happening. For me, as a layman, I'm thinking hackathon, lots of nerds like myself, but without the technical capability, sitting around laptops, you know, hacking. That's not quite what it is. It's far more interesting than that. And it was held the 18th to the 20th of April on the USS Hornet in Alameda, San Francisco. You founded it and hosted it along with Marilyn Ma, I believe is her name. Yeah.
Yeah. Marilyn Ma. Yeah. You got it.
So start off, what is a hackathon for people like myself who are like, what is going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. So the origin of the concept of the hackathon kind of comes from this idea of you'll typically get programmers, but in this version of the hackathon, it's people hacking things together. That's really what it means. I know that, Lou, for example, he was super kind. He gave us shout out. I think he thought that we meant we were working initially. We were working on cybersecurity, like a cybersecurity hackathon. Mm. But it's actually a cybersecurity would be a subset of generally a general hackathon where, you're building a technology or a solution to solve a very specific set of problems over a weekend or over a day. It depends, but it's a very small amount of time that you have to solve this problem. There will be sponsors and prizes and different tracks and so on and so forth.
So you had Gary Nolan was involved, Daniel Sheehan, James Fowler from Skywatcher, Jesse Michaels. There was a lot of big names there. What was the purpose of the event then? So you've got all these folks who are really well known within ufology now through different disciplines, whether it's media, science, academia, legal.
Yeah.
And then you've got all these folks working on all these different issues and problems to do with the UAP topic. So can you talk around some of those deep and kind of what was worked on over that weekend?
Happily, yeah. So the context for the hackathon, before I answer that, so it makes my answer more relevant, was that I wanted to quickly develop technology. But basically, the idea is to tap into this $1 trillion DNA and structure. Because like, if you think about it, a lot of the people in the Bay Area, the sort of top talent, or even just like the median talent really, contribute to this like modern civilization. Like without, without Meta, without Tesla, without SpaceX, you know, without Apple, right, and Microsoft and Google, like we use Google every day. Without these things, we would have a totally different, a more boring civilization. We would be much farther away from disclosure as well. So the idea was, how do we tap into that spirit and that talent that powers those massive world-changing organizations and enterprises, and basically enable them to clearly find tangible solutions that will help the UFO community? So that was the idea. Yeah, I spent a lot of money, well north over $50,000 on this thing to get it going. We rented out the USS Navy carrier called, it's an aircraft carrier, naval carrier. We rented out the USS Hornet. What else? The real context, though, yeah, was just like, how do you merge these two worlds together? That was like what I was trying to do, really. And the hackathon was just like the expression of it, to simply stated. Like, I needed to do something real, like really physically real, that binds these two worlds together, not just talk about it, which is what we had all been doing, actually, all of us, for the last 70 plus years, in Silicon Valley at least. So, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's fair. But it would be very easy and obvious of me to say, okay, so do you get all these great minds together? And over that weekend, you say, okay, solve the UFO topic, solve this puzzle and mystery. That's probably too big to happen over a couple of days. Sort of pieces of the puzzle were actually being worked on, and what kind of came from that?
Yeah, heck yeah. So let's just, I'll talk a little bit about the mission tracks and the general themes of the hackathon. We had six in total. Those basically, the six, no particular order. We had the humanity soft landing. So the humanity soft landing chain, one, or train, if you will, is essentially dedicated to developing an open source decentralized platform to allow humans and generally also AIs as well to collect data on NHI, so that we can open source it and trade both data and methods on gathering more data on NHI freely amongst each other. So the idea is, how do you develop this sort of like platform that, long story short, will enable a publicly funded, publicly owned UAP crash recovery program? That was the humanity soft landing. That one, Danny Sheehan really killed it. So like as a sort of like mentor. So, you know, he would have dozens of people around him. A lot of these guys were like hackers, engineers, and stuff like that. And so that was really cool, where they were like learning about all the different nuances and problems with establishing a chain of provenance, why that's so important. And then people were thinking about, oh, what technology stacks, like we should put this on chain. And what chain would that be? Would it be IPFS? How do we design it? You know, like, so there were people sort of like working on those. So that's one track. Another track was the propulsion track. So that's your classic track, which was, the problem was, can you simulate or design new alternative propulsion systems that could explain UAP? Or could you develop technologies for detecting or tracking those propulsion systems for UAP? So in that track, that track was sponsored largely by Skywatcher. So that was really cool. We were given very specific problem sets of like the kinds of problems that Skywatcher runs into when they go out to the field to measure stuff. And so we broke those problems down and then gave those to these hackers within this mission track. And some of these guys, several of these teams, made tangible progress that neither Skywatcher, nobody had done, which was why they had sponsored, you know, that track.
So I have to ask you on that, because actually interesting. Did you have direct data from Skywatcher, or was it more general? Here's an issue we have. Can you work on that?
Yeah, it was a general issue. It was a prompt. The okay. theme of the event or the hackathon was give us, yeah, like what the particular tier that Skywatcher picked was the prompt-based one. So okay. they gave us, yeah, prompts.
And can you talk at all around what the actual issues were? Because that's something people are going to want to hear about, you know, and what they were kind of looking for help with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. So, you know, and this is on our website. We've also posted it. I think we're going to be putting out a whole lot more content as well on this entire hackathon. So, you know, I refuse to, you know, play the whole Seekers game, of course. And so, right. So anyways, yeah, I think simply stated the way that I would think about this, broadly speaking, like these are the problems. Now the data, you know, what proprietary data, even I don't have access to that. I don't want access to that just yet without having the right infrastructure agreements and so on and blah, 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 blah. We can get into that. broadly speaking, I would think about it in three categories. First category is essentially the infrared object detection and tracking problem. So the problem goes like this. In optical imagery, when you have regular cameras that just see within the visible spectrum, right? So like your average DSLR or your average Nikon camera, right? These guys, there's lots of both open source and private object detection motion tracking algorithms for that, that will, you know, be like quite efficient, actually quite useful. Now, when you go into the infrared spectrum, the game becomes a lot more messy and a lot more complicated. So there's really only like one or two available infrared like object detection tracking motion algorithms and pieces of softwares out there. And part of it is regulation. Part of it is just complexity of the problem. So like, because like, think about it, right? Like here's the problem, like just to build some intuition for like what we're dealing with. You have a object that's like, let's say you have some UAP that's like 50,000 feet away from you and is traveling at like 6,000, 7,000, you know, miles per hour. You know, first of all, we're not going to see it with the naked eye 50,000 feet away unless it wants to be seen, in my opinion. So okay, yep. Like, let's assume it doesn't want to be seen, and we're still trying to track these things. Like we're still trying to find them. That's the whole point, right? Is to outsmart at least some of these things, at least some of the time. that's the game. And so in those cases, they will often show up in infrared. This is just like, you know, right. Just the intuition for like, the fact that just based off the fact that all objects give off heat. So, you know, if you're looking for like heat or some kind of heat signature, that would be the general thinking. So anyways, what the problem is that as you go deeper and deeper into the infrared wavelength and spectrum, the farther this object is, the more fainter it's going to be. And generally speaking, the harder the resolution will be to resolve. And so what ends up happening is this sort of like perfect storm, if you will. So the object is faint, it's in the background, your camera sees it, and you're trying to lock onto it and keep like detecting it and clearly differentiate it between other objects. So not an easy problem, but it is solvable. And it is also, yeah, very, very useful in general for other cases, scientific applications like, yeah, asteroid detection in space. Right. Yep. For example. So all that is to say that was category number one. Category two and three of problems that were sort of subsets of this propulsion track that we had were how do you, once you've detected the object, how do you then essentially triangulate these things, right? So, you know, first of all, there's a whole bunch of different kinds of data that you're going to be getting. There's passive radar data and there's active radar data that you can tap into with UAP detection. Passive radar, you know, is essentially, I'm going to exploit the fact that there's radio frequencies sort of, you know, seeming out into the world everywhere from these radio towers and so on and so forth. And as those radio waves, you know, bounce off of planes and bounce off of UAPs, right? I'll detect those waves. So it's kind of like being very cheeky in the sense that you're taking leverage of the fact that we're bathed in electromagnetic radiation. So why not leverage that fact and detect reflected electromagnetic radiation across the entire spectrum?
Yeah.
And so that's like, so problem number two is how do you build really that sensor fusion stack for it? Like introducing passive radar, you know, hyperspectral imagery. There's so many things to do here still. A ton.
And so then, can I just ask, so I understand that properly, and yeah. I like an analogy. You've seen the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a little bit like in the third movie when Bruce Wayne uses everyone's cell phones as like a map and he can use that pattern to see like the buildings and everything because he's using the data that's already out there?
That's very similar. Very much.
I can understand that. That's okay, right. Cool. Yeah.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah, analogy. Yeah.
Comic book
or
movies.
Like, or another something. One is, you know how bats use echolocation?
Yep.
This would be the kind of opposite of that. It would be like if you're walking through a canyon, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this is a good example. It'll help, yeah, kind of hopefully give us both intuition or empathy for the Skywatcher guys. You're going through the Grand Canyon and you've got a loud voice and a microphone and you can like echo, right? Like you can yell really loud into the microphone, for example, a bunch of times. And then, you know, what you realize is that if you got a good ear, you might realize that, okay, certain tunes, I detect this kind of Doppler effect, or I detect changes in the frequency. And then, you know, a person with maybe some really good geospatial, you know, intuition, right, might say, okay, well, what that means is that there's some sort of like jagged array over here, like in the canyon that we can expect because pitch changed. But the problem is that because you're in a canyon, your voice is going to echo like crazy. And you have multiple voices. Let's say you have five of your friends and they're all talking, and you still have to pinpoint your own voice in those five voices to figure out like where this jagged piece of the rock is. It's far, far harder, right? Because now you're picking it out amongst your own echo and five other people's echoes. It's a mess. So that's passive radar detection for you. So that's really problem number two, is how do you pick that apart, find the signal in that noise? Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. I like that. Yep.
Yay. Awesome. And of course, the jagged thing was the UAP. and then the third one, third category is... very simply stated, this is almost like poetically powerful, I guess. It has to do with the gimbal. Mm. How do you essentially rotate the gimbal on these systems so that they all point at the same thing? It sounds very simple, simply stated. But when you have like less than microseconds, sometimes femtoseconds to figure this out, that's a really, really non-trivial problem to solve. So those were, yeah, the three for the subset, which was number two of six problems. Yeah.
So is a femtosecond less than a microsecond?
Much less, yeah.
I never knew. I've never heard that before. So there you go.
Yeah, there's femtosecond, attosecond, and zeptoseconds, which is even smaller.
Yeah, I can imagine you could go even deeper than that. So yeah. That's pretty cool. And off the back of the event, then it's a couple of days. What are some of the successes then? You've talked about some of these problems being worked on. Is there anything that really has grown arms and legs and is going to be a longer term project for individuals or groups?
Several. Yeah, that's a great question. Where do I start? I think one project that I'm really, really bullish on, I'm bullish on several of them, actually. One that I'm particularly close to is the material science guys. So these are the guys who won number one first place. We chose them for a number of reasons. So our metric for judging the projects, we had like over like a dozen plus submissions. And like 20, 30 plus teams who had initially signed up with over like 150 plus participants initially. So the judging criteria was two. One was what is the commercial viability and applicability in the real world, like outside of just UAPs? Because if it doesn't have commercial viability, it's never going to go anywhere. That's literally the number one. That's why we have so many actual grifters in the field and also accusations of grifters in the field, right? Because like, there's no way to fund this shit without like selling t-shirts or something. Like, you know, that's just like, it's a silly economics, or selling movies or whatever, documentaries or whatever the hell, right? So that was one of the criterion. The other criterion was essentially actual efficacy of the solution. Did you address the thing? How well did you address it? Better than everybody else in the room for that particular mission track, and relative to all the other missions. So that was the general thing. First place was they call themselves Arrow. I forget the actual name of the the thing, but it was Knock on Arrow.
But it wasn't Sean Kozlowski. It wasn't Sean Kirkpatrick or John Kozlowski. It wasn't those guys all turning up to solve their own problems, because that would have been funny.
They're welcome to participate, though. They're always maybe the next one they'll be there. Who knows?
open to all. Yeah, but that's pretty cool. I totally appreciate that anything like that requires funding, and funding and monetization is always a dirty word in the UFO topic, especially. And that's where I think, and we'll get to talk about Skywatcher soon in more detail, at least they are privately funded and they haven't gone out asking for crowdsourcing, for crowdfunding. They're not selling tickets yet for anything. You know, they are funded through various means, because it takes off some of that pressure that maybe the UFO community would be putting on them. But to the other end of that, like you say, if I develop a gadget which can detect UFOs and I try and sell and market that, you're honing in on such a small audience. And then to get venture capitalists or just folk who want to throw some money at you for fun, if you can then say, well, not only does it find UFOs, it actually finds secret Chinese spy balloons when they fly over your country. And all of a sudden, military industrial complex want to get involved in that, and it's totally for UFO detection, but we can detect spy balloons, we can detect, you know, we can detect hypersonic missiles when they are launched over 5,000 miles away. More people have more of an interest, and that gets more folks on board, even though the baby that you wanted, that idea that was birthed, was I want to find UFOs. That's a much harder sell still.
100%. It really is. I think you hit the nail on the head, because ultimately what you don't want to do is shoot yourself in the foot and have a very good understanding of the problem and like just be totally solution driven, right? And fail to actually sort of work backwards. Like a lot of people just want to go out with a solution. Like I have this UFO detection thing. I'm just going to go and sell it as is or whatever. I think we have to, as a community, just be more systematic. Everything related to UFO and UAP detection, that's the other difficulty and just thing to be mindful of, is that anything that I can use to detect a fast traveling object is also useful for the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, that's what it comes down to, I think, is like there is that, this is Danny Sheehan's gripe with all of this, right? This whole thing is that national security constantly is used as a sort of, you know, oppressive tool at times, if you will, you know, depends on who you are. Skywatcher is privately funded. Open NHI, which is the organization, it's a protocol that Marilyn and I are developing. We haven't actually founded the organization yet, like officially on paper or whatever. The idea is to essentially democratize the UFO detection track and stack completely, so that you and I can have it for free, or like at least the knowledge of assembling and building our own. And of course you can buy kits and so on and so forth. And so what that will do is because what we're doing is essentially we're taking some of the kits that other, you know, UAP detection folks have been building and so on and so forth. We're looking at those as inspiration. We're looking at our own designs. And what we decided was, okay, we're just going to make our own like ultra stack. We're going to completely open source it so that anyone has the blueprints. They can make it. You can make it. Anybody can. Doesn't matter. We're going to open source the software so that infrared detection thing that I was talking about, we'll open source that. We'll keep developing it and just offer it to the world. And so you, at one point, for a few hundred bucks, this is the dream, you'll be able to either just purchase a kit directly, just literally just beautiful, like white looking egg is what I'm visualizing with like a bunch of like radar sensors and stuff like that at home. You know, the idea is that let's say it costs like $300 or what have you, or, you know, you deal with pounds as pounds.
Yeah, right? So what, 250 pounds. Yeah, that's well, 240.
So yeah, so let's say 240 is excellent, actually. So, you know, you got 240 pounds to pay for this thing. The idea is that in this network, because whatever data you're detecting is going to be valuable for anyone, for other UFO researchers like Skywatchers or the Skywatchers of the world, right? So the idea is to basically be able to reward you as you keep track of these, like as your sensor takes in data passively throughout the day, you would be paid by the Open NHI network, you know, like maybe 5 pounds per day, so that you're now at 150 pounds. Or like, I'll be more like realistic. It might be like one pound per day initially, sure, whatever the network is. But in any case, let's say 1 pound, so that you're at 30 pounds, right, per month. That's still 10 pounds more per month than what you paid for. So by the end of the year, right, you have 120 pounds more than what we started with, and you have a crap ton of data and your sensor, and you've helped contribute to UFO research. So that's the name of the game. That way, what that will do is that will basically push the proprietary thing that will differentiate the difference between a bunch of UFO Twitter nerds, right, like banding together and buying a bunch of sensors, like you and I, for example, or like setting it up with like Lou or whoever, right? Like any random person, you know, and like doing that versus like a DoD, you know, that this removes that barrier. This, there is no difference anymore at that level. And so what that means is that the only difference between our UFO crash recovery effort, which would be a the world's first public UFO crash recovery effort, global public, the only difference between us and like maybe private, a government, is really the dog whistle, or any other private entity, any other private crash recovery effort, really, versus our public effort. It's that dog whistle. I don't know. I've said a lot, so I'm just going
to
stop.
No. I have to ask what I feel is an obvious question now. Say this is successful, and Deep and Marilyn and whoever else get this off the ground, you know, which I would hope you do, and you get people who are up for this, and it's affordable and it's manageable, it's accessible for people. If you have an open sourced, you know, you're crowdsourcing data, people are getting stuff back for it, and you hope to have this, you know, crash retrieval detection project. Is that not incredibly difficult when you have, and it gets into the kind of the UFO problem here, governments, private contractors, military industrial complex, who perhaps don't want you doing this, especially if it's something that genuinely works?
100%. Yeah. So the, right on. So Matthew Pines yesterday asked me this. He was just like, and I haven't even replied, and I will after this conversation.
When you do reply to him, just tell him to reply to my email that he asked me to send him. That would be handy.
Sure. You're hilarious. We'll do it.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm not joking. Please do. Yeah, thanks.
I got you, brother. You're so funny. So Matthew basically was just like, a UFO lands in Golden Gate Park. What is your next step? Like, what do you specifically do next, right? And I was like I thought about this, and I actually gave a talk on this very topic in New York about a month and a half or 2 months ago. Basically when I was revealing OpenNHI, actually, before the hackathon. But basically what we're gonna need is our own militia. First of all, I know that sounds crazy, but like the public needs its own representation. Unfortunately, the public is no longer being represented in terms of its best interests. So what I think would have to happen is that we would band together. I haven't worked out all the details, as you can tell, because there's certain things that I simply just don't think I should say right now, because I'm playing chess against a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, but like, but yeah, but basically, you know, I will say this because I was going to say this publicly anyway, so it's all good. We're chill. That's fine. So the UFO lands, let's be practical. And like, let's take the Golden Gate Park. I really like that example particularly because I know how like almost lawless that place is. Like there's like no police presence. They don't give a shit. It's very
Where is that for those of us not in the US? And you're Canadian, aren't you? So, you know, where's Golden Gate Park?
Golden Gate Park is in San Francisco.
Okay, next to the Golden Gate Bridge, I take it?
Yeah, exactly. That's literally it. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so, you know, you're just like looking at the bridge, you're at the park, you know, big, beautiful red bridge, right? You know, this massive 50-foot radius saucer just like gently lands, right? What's the next move? And so I'm going to answer this assuming that, yeah, I doubt this will happen in the next 5 years, so it doesn't matter. But like, if it does, like, my answer will be different, right? Yeah, like, obviously,
start the stopwatch now, and not in the next 5 years. Okay, so you've got till June 2030.
Yeah, god dang, exactly. So, assuming, yeah, this happens around that time frame. You know, what I would do, because again, my personal goal is over the next 5 years, really just establish this like sort of multi-billion-dollar enterprise. The next company that I'm building, I really want it to be massive. Like have a massive multi, like 100 constellation of satellites. I want to send payloads to Mars as soon as the first starships are available. I want to be on those. Like I want to be able to design those things, privately fund all those things. So in 5 years, the first thing I would do is I would get a ring from one of my reconnaissance like experts, or maybe the OpenNHI bat signal would get activated. In fact, that's much more preferable. So we all know where this thing is.
Yeah.
And it's not just like a private group or the damn DOD or something like that. And then what I would do is immediately send this like private militia to secure it. So because you see, there is no law that says that that's government property. There is no law that would stop anyone from taking it from what I can see. Now, the government is half like they're welcome to pass legislature that clearly states if an alien spacecraft lands in San Francisco, it is their property. But until they do, I'm gonna fucking take it if I can.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Like, you know, so first thing we're doing is we're sending all these drones. We're gonna send a whole bunch of people, you know, our guys, like we'll hire, you know, we'll contract Palantir or whoever the hell does this stuff, like, you know, Eric Prince, doesn't matter. I don't give a shit. Yeah. Right. Surround it, take it, bring it to the heart of San Francisco. And then just make it, surround it in a giant bulletproof sort of warehouse that's like totally reinforced. Either I'm playing with it. I was thinking about the heart of San Francisco, although I did have another thought that maybe it should be farther out, like a couple hours away from any major city, just because. Really, what if it fucking blows up and kills? What if it's an antimatter weapon in there that like literally kills everybody? Like, you know what I mean? Like, if this is nuclear technology, I don't know if it's safe to be touching that stuff.
So even take it out onto the water, like out to the ocean.
Perhaps, yeah. So totally, yeah. That's a great point. Yeah, you could totally, yeah. Yeah, there's actually already precedents for that. So in biotech, for example, there are transhumanists and people who are focused working on themselves and stuff like that, you know, augmenting the human body, as you know. Some of these folks will actually go into international waters. Some of these, you know, billionaires, for example, they'll actually have their own labs that let them do research, but there's no like
laws. Yeah.
So you might want to do that simply because you don't want some country coming in and trying to kill you. Because the second, if I succeed, right, like I being all of us, because the whole point is that this is like not going to be, oh, a deep Prasad enterprise owned UFO. That's not what I want. Like I did maybe 5 years ago, I envisioned that that's how things will go because everybody else is doing that. So I'm like, okay, yeah. But no, I think it should be the publicly owned. But like the second that happens, whoever's responsible for that group though, is now a giant target. Like you are absolutely people will absolutely try to take your shit. Like, it doesn't matter who you are.
Let me bring the point up then. Are you under the assumption that this object is empty and has nothing inside it and is almost being gifted to us to be taken? Because I imagine there are folks, and you know what the UFO argument and the UFO community is like, who will be listening
to this. That is
my question,
by the way, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Because for the last few minutes, someone will have been thinking, fuck you, Deep Prasad. These aliens have landed and it sounds like you've kidnapped them and taken their stuff. So I'm just, like you say, the assumption here is it's been gifted. It's very Diana Pasulka gifting field. It's something that's been given to us. It's there.
That is absolutely
take it. And you're commandeering it for the purpose of study, for research, for the public, for the greater good, not for I am from Lockheed Martin. I am taking this and it's now mine to do with what I wish. Yeah, cool.
You got it. That's absolutely right. I'm glad you cleared that up, because if there are NHI present, or any other form of superintelligence, any form of coherent intelligence that we can communicate with, let's just put it that way, that does change the dynamics. Then it's a negotiation, like contact sort of experience thing.
Can I have your saucer just for a day or two? Just kind of going to borrow that?
Pretty much. I mean, if they're landing, they're doing it for a purpose, right? So these things are super calculated. And so, you know, the theory or the idea there is that, or the intuition is that if we have a good enough, because one of the biggest disservices that I think Hollywood does is that it paints aliens as these like primitive sort of just highly advanced weapons and space travel tech, but very primitive, right? Like, low impulse control, monstrous beings, ugly, not emotionally intelligent, prone to violence and invasion and conquering and blah, 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 blah. But I don't think that's what an advanced civilization would actually look like. In fact, if you have talked to ChatGPT, for example, or some of these other advanced AI tools today, they're oftentimes more emotionally intelligent than the average person. This is at least my personal belief. They can just, sometimes read the room, read the situation better. And so imagine extrapolating that by thousands of years. Like, what happens if there's a civilization that naturally sort of evolved with that level of intelligence trajectory? They will understand us emotionally in ways that we literally cannot comprehend and calculate. I think there will never be a scenario where you have this monstrous, totally ape-like violent thing that comes here and then preys on us or doesn't understand human interactions or doesn't understand human customs, doesn't know how to spy on us well enough to determine what our social hierarchies are, who the precedent is, who's who isn't listened to, who won't be respected if they talk about their experience out loud, right? These things, we'll obviously know all these things. So
I want to ask you then, I was going to bring this in because my plan was to get you, as we go along, go from logical to the AI stuff would come in and then start to go a little bit more speculative and woo, but tie it all back in, right? But I'm going to kind of jump forward a little bit. So because this is something, actually, I got an email yesterday from a listener, Craig, who's been a long-time listener, and he was saying that he feels this podcast and so many others that he likes right now are being so almost news-like, and we're reporting on Congress and policy and all that kind of stuff. And he's there's so much going on, but he was like, sometimes we can almost forget to talk about the fun, speculative, we're talking about aliens, we're talking about UFOs.
Especially these days. The early days used to be way more dominant. Like even 5-6 years ago, that was all a lot.
Yeah, 100%. And it almost gets not boring in the sense of boring, you know, putting you to sleep, but it can become very news-like and very, you know, rigid. Oh, so I want to ask you then, Deep, on that, because you've brought it up, not me. What do you think right now in terms of this overall phenomenon, given you've had kind of 5 or 6 years publicly dealing with a lot of really interesting folks and interesting organizations? You've already name dropped Matthew Pines. You've talked about Lou Elizondo, Gary Nolan, Danny Sheehan. You're hanging out with Jesse Michaels doing interviews last year, you know. So you're speaking to a lot of folks involved in a lot of different aspects of this conversation. Mm-hmm. So how has your opinion changed or formed as to what we might actually be dealing with in terms of You mentioned flying saucer for your example, but then we've got these tic-tac objects. We've got these eggs being picked up by whistleblowers. What is going on in terms of what we're dealing with?
That is all for part one. Part two will be out in the next couple of days. You can listen to this episode already in full, ad-free, and with no sponsors for less than the price of a coffee. If you head on over to Patreon or Apple, you can subscribe to the podcast for less than the price of a coffee or take up the 2 weeks free trial that are available on those platforms. You can head on over to Spotify and search That UFO Podcast Premium and get access to this episode in full, no adverts, no sponsorships, and also with some extra bonus content as well. Thanks for listening, folks.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org.